At the risk of telling you something you already know all too well, the cost of just about everything is going up. The Labor Department released new inflation numbers today. Consumer prices are up 5.6% compared with this time last year. That's the biggest increase in 17 years.
If you've been to the meat counter at the supermarket lately, you've no doubt felt that increase. And if you think it's bad now, just wait a few months. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, high feed and fuel prices mean that that steak you're eyeing will likely cost a lot more this fall.
Right now, next fall's steak is ambling towards the gate, eyeing its dinner at Robert and Gail Seddon's farm. These cows' feeding time is taking a big bite out of Old Town Farm's profit. So the Central Virginia farmers are paring their herd of 25 down to 10 this year.
I've got to sell 8 of them or 9 of them just to cover the cost of feed.
Robert Seddon says the price of feed has increased 50%. Hay has doubled from 2 years ago. Add the increase in gas and diesel, and the profit from a beef cow is half what it was.
Somebody's making money. It ain't me, though.
Commodity prices have backed off a bit in recent weeks, but global grain demand is still outstripping supply. And as a result, meat prices in general are headed for a bigger spike.
A lot of people are severely reducing the size of their herds, and that may cap the beef price. But once they run out of animals to cull and sell off, beef prices are going to shoot through the roof.
We're not going to really see until September, October, November, the supplies start to shrink a little bit.
Heather Vaughn is a spokeswoman for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. She says some are simply shutting down.
A few years ago, we were seeing about 900,000 people across the country raising cattle, and today that number is closer to 760,000.
In fact, the USDA recently said beef cow inventory decreased 1% from last year to about 33 million cattle. Since earlier this year, the wholesale price of beef has increased about 18%. Just 10 miles north of Seddon's farm, farmer John Goodwin says he's adapting to increased costs. To save money, Goodwin plans to let his 300 cows graze longer on grass. But his herd also eats a mix of grains and plant that looks like dry cereal and smells like old beer.
And it's high in energy, and it's also high in protein.
But it also fluctuates in price and is expensive to ship. So 2 months ago, Goodwin's family built a huge concrete storage unit designed to store feed.
We're looking to be able to buy products when they're at the cheapest and then store them for however long we need to till we can fully utilize them. This is a way that we can help improve our cost of production so we lower it.
Goodwin says he has a vested interest in running an efficient operation, and not just for the welfare of his business. After all, he's a consumer himself. His favorite foods?
Steak and ice cream are probably the top ones. And that's not because I'm a beef producer.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
For Kitchen Window, I'm Bonnie Wolfe. Susan Russo is a food writer in San Diego. She publishes stories, recipes, and photos on her cooking blog, Food Blogger. She has written a piece for Kitchen Window Online about everyone's favorite summer subject, corn. She joins me today. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Bonnie.
Why does everybody love corn so much?
I think because it's just such a fun food to eat. When you think about it, it's one of the few foods that is expected to be eaten with your hands. You can just slather it with butter and salt, or you can get a little fancy and sprinkle some lime juice on it, or you can sprinkle some cheese on it, and it goes with everything. It's just such a laid-back food. I think it's like Americans, you know? We like to have fun. We like to be laid back. It's a barbecue and a cookout kind of food, and it's just something that everybody loves.
There does seem to be an affinity with lime. Do you have any idea why?
Well, I think it's mostly from Mexico. That's where we get the influence from, because lime and lemon as well actually helps to bring out the corn flavor much more than even just, say, butter does. Hmm. There's something about the acidity that interacts with the sugars in the corn and makes the corn have more of that intense corn flavor and kind of enhance the sweetness.
What do you do with corn and lime?
Sometimes I just make a plain ear of corn. I boil it or steam it or grill it and just literally just sprinkle some lime and a little bit of salt on it and maybe a little bit of cayenne pepper. Also, one of my favorite dishes, which I talk about in the piece, and I actually share the recipe in the online piece, is for Mexican grilled corn, which is absolutely addictive. You just grill the corn, and then you slather it with this lime-spiked mayonnaise sauce, and then you roll it in crumbly Mexican cotija añejo cheese.
Which is?
It's a crumbly, salty cheese that's mildly aged, and it can be found in regular supermarkets or Mexican markets. It's pretty easy to find, actually. It just has a wonderful flavor. And when you roll the corn in it, all these little knobby pieces of cheese stick to the hot corn.
Oh,
and then you sprinkle it with lime and chili powder or cayenne pepper and some fresh cilantro, and it is just a slice of heaven, I'm telling you.
Sounds like it. not to go back to the very beginning, but corn is also such an American food, and I think we think that too because they didn't have corn in Europe, and the colonists came here and the Native Americans introduced them to corn.
Yeah. When the colonists came to America, the Native Americans had already been growing and using corn for many, many years prior to that. So when they came, the colonists, specifically Christopher Columbus, is believed to be the first colonist and his men to actually see the Indians growing corn. And they were, of course, fascinated. So they would talk to the Native Americans to learn how to grow this. And then, of course, out of necessity, they had to learn to grow it themselves because when their own food supplies would run out, such as wheat or rice, they would have to rely on corn. So really what happened was there was this cultural exchange between the colonists and the Native Americans, and a lot of foods were born from this time.
What kind of foods?
Cornbread, you know, things like Johnny cakes or hoe cakes, grits and hominy, because what happened was the colonists would see the Indians making these dishes, and the Indians used a lot of stone ground corn because it was something that they could make and then they could use throughout the cold winter months when they weren't able to grow fresh produce. So they would use this ground corn, and they would often make a mash out of it, and then they would bake it over an open fire. And so all these different names of different foods emerged, such as Johnny cakes or ash cakes or hoe cakes, and they were all basically referring to the same thing. And the colonists saw this, and they tried to mimic it, and they also incorporated their own European techniques. And that's how we ended up getting, you know, basic American staples like cornbread and corn muffins and corn pudding.
Corn became a very important part of the diet.
Oh, absolutely, because it was a staple for Native American diets, and then it became a staple when Columbus went back to Europe. He took corn with him, and within one or two generations, it basically spread throughout all of Europe and then quickly ended up spreading throughout the world.
Yeah.
And so it was something that was easy to grow in a lot of different climates. It was pretty inexpensive, and it was something that you could use throughout the winter months when you couldn't grow other things. So it was something that people all over the world found, you know, really desirable, and that's why today, in fact, corn is the third leading crop in the world.
Is that right? How, and corn has changed a great deal with hybridization and crossbreeding, and what have we gained by all of this?
Well, what we've gained is a much sweeter ear of corn, a more robust corn that could sustain harsher weather, and corn that could yield a much larger crop. What we've lost in that process, though, is some of that true corn flavor. It's hard to describe, but we all know it when we taste it. And a lot of people feel that the corn that we eat today, which is pretty much all of the corn we eat today, is from a variety called super sweet corn. And what that is it's, like the name implies, a super sweet tasting corn because it has very high sugar content, almost three times as much as a traditional ear of corn would have had. So you have that sweet flavor, but the drawback is that it's a much less creamy corn. It has crunchier kernels and less of that corn milk that makes corn creamy. And a lot of people feel that it has a lack of true corn flavor.
We have heirloom tomatoes and antique apples. Are they starting to grow old kinds of corns that are sweeter?
Yes. they absolutely are. In fact, a lot of people are saying that's going to be the next trend, that there's going to be, you know, kind of a backlash against this super sweet corn and to try to get back to the old-fashioned corn flavor that we used to have.
How do you pick a good ear of corn?
Well, the first thing you should actually look for is make sure that the corn hasn't been sitting out in the sun all day, because when corn is exposed to high heat, it breaks down the sugars. So once you find some corn, hold it in your hand and make sure it feels heavy for its size. And the husk should be a nice bright green, and it should be taut. It shouldn't be shriveled, and it shouldn't have any mold spots on it. And then just gently pull back the top of the husk, and what you want to look for is plump, full kernels, and you want to look for a silk that is light-colored, beige or golden-colored, and that's still dry, that isn't wet or moldy. And then once you take it home, it's best to keep it in the husk so that you retain moisture, and put it in a plastic bag, and then keep it in the crisper drawer of your refrigerator. And most corn today will last up to a week, but the sooner you eat the corn, the better it'll taste.
How do you freeze corn?
To freeze corn, you just remove it from the husk, you blanch it in boiling water for about 2 minutes, and then run it under cool water to cool it off, and then just cut off the kernels, place them in a single layer on a cookie sheet, and put them in the freezer. That way they don't freeze into clumps. And then once they're frozen, just put them inside of heavy-duty freezer bags, like Ziploc bags, and then you can enjoy them year-round.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Turning to the Olympics, you'd think there might be some good Chinese food at the stadiums there, but no. One reporter who's covering the game says he's had no end of frustration finding decent snacks at the events. We reached Trip Mickle. He writes for Sports Business Journal, and we reached him in Beijing. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What have you been able to eat?
Well, I think the most challenging night was when I went out to the basketball game a couple of nights ago when USA played China. I found myself outside reporting, came inside, expected to just grab a hot dog, and that's when I kind of confronted Chinese concessions. Just completely different. There's no offering at any of the venues of cooked food. It's all prepackaged, and I plan on grabbing a hot dog, and that's certainly not available.
Well, let me ask you, why did you expect you might get a hot dog there in Beijing? Is it that the Chinese have been attempting to make everything, you know, just right in a sense?
I think it's a combination of that and the fact that that arena is being operated by the NBA and Anschutz Entertainment Group, which are, you know, two of the largest sports business providers in the U.S. So with their operational expertise, I expected, you know, sure enough, they're going to have a hot dog there. Interestingly enough, when AEG and the NBA signed their agreement to come in and operate the Olympic basketball stadium after the games, they took a look at the plans and saw that the plans didn't even include concession stands. And so they made the recommendation, hey, you might want to have this. And so they built small alcoves where they're serving prepackaged food over folding wooden tables during the basketball games right now. And then AEG and the NBA are going to come in and put in, you know, the right power system and all that stuff to be able to cook meals at the concession booths in China.
But would this be a little too late for you there at the Olympics?
Yeah, a little too late for me. I left pretty hungry that night, for sure. I think dinner included Snickers and an apple, so...
Does that mean there isn't a lot of snacking at sports events in China, or is it that the Chinese normally, say, bring in food from vendors outside? Because certainly in cities there can be a lot of great street food.
Right, certainly. And one of the things I've noticed here in Beijing is, at least during the games, the streets are pretty clear of street vendors. And when I got inside the beach volleyball arena today, I sat down with a 24-year-old Chinese man who was eating breakfast at the concession stand and asked him a little bit about that. And he said that what they had was pretty typical. And I explained to him that in the West, we have, you know, we can cook an entire meal and serve it at a sporting event. And he looks at me just kind of wide-eyed and goes, that's amazing.
So have you been able to getting out of the venues, the sports venues, and get out there and get downtown Beijing and have something good?
The best part about getting out of the venues and getting out and having something is discovering the price. I bought a plate of steamed vegetables and beef on rice. Bought two of those. It was a great deal. It was like $4.
And delicious?
It was great. I mean, it was delicious, and the, you know, you couldn't beat the price, and the food was terrific.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee. I had a wonderful time talking with you.
Trip Mickle is a staff reporter for Sports Business Journal. He's in Beijing reporting about the business of the Olympics.
We live in an era where chefs have become personalities, corporate moguls, brand names. For instance, you've undoubtedly heard of Emeril, as in the chef named Emeril Lagasse. Well, he sold his brand name and other parts of his food empire recently for $50 million. But NPR's Daniel Zwerdling spent the morning with an acclaimed chef who has followed a different path. Danny joins us in our studio. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Leanne. Good to be here.
Danny, why don't you tell everybody without further ado, who's the chef, where was he cooking, and what was he making?
I love this story. The chef's name is Steve Bett, and I joined him as he and a group of volunteers were making a six-course breakfast for more than 200 homeless people. Bett actually used to cook in trendy restaurants, the sort of places, Leanne, that were reviewed by the New York Times and the Washington Post, got very good reviews. In fact, Bett dreamed that he would run his own restaurant someday.
Just like Emeril.
Exactly. Except that one day, Steve Bett walked right out of the restaurant world. He quit. And he decided his new mission is to run a soup kitchen. They're in the basement of a church here in Washington, D.C. It's about 1 mile from the White House. And they call the program Miriam's Kitchen. I got there at about 6 a.m.
Oh, Jim, so go through this donation from the farmer's market. You want to sort through the bad greens. You see those?
And Steve Bett was already supervising 8 volunteers. He signs up hundreds of volunteers during the year as a sous chefs. Maybe we're in a church, but this looks like it could be in a restaurant. Huge restaurant stoves, gargantuan pots.
Just start to break it with your hands. Look for the stuff you would eat at home. Dump it in the water. Spin it, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, fine. It's hard to get Steve Bett to stand still. He's small and wiry. He's always jiggling like a steel spring. They've got less than an hour now to cook breakfast. Homeless men and women are already pouring into the dining room on the other side of the door. They come mainly for the breakfast, but they often stay to get blankets or soap or referrals to drug rehab. They sometimes even find a job.
So the menu will be omelets, and Chris is making some omelets, and the omelets have sautéed mushrooms and ham, onions, and some farmer's market cheese. We'll have stone ground grits, some homemade home fries that we do here that are really popular. We'll have a farmer's market green salad. We're going to do like a strawberry shortcake.
This is for the breakfast, right?
This is for the breakfast.
Yeah. Okay, full disclosure. Is this really a typical breakfast here, or is this like special because we happen to be here?
This is a typical breakfast. You know, we're trying to treat the homeless here, the clients, the guests we serve, with dignity. And I switch back and forth, clients, guests, because we do call them clients, but at the same time, I always try to tell volunteers to think of it as a guest coming into your home.
So what clicked in your brain, or maybe in your heart, that you dropped your fantasy of becoming chef of your own restaurant and you decided to work for a homeless kitchen?
I remember the moment clearly. My wife, who was my girlfriend at that time, basically said, it's the restaurants or me. It was very hard to have a good relationship and at the same time think about a future family with those type of hours. And so at that point I said, okay, restaurants aren't going to work, but I wanted to figure out how could I merge my restaurant experience to wanting to kind of help people. You know, it's funny because my mom, I think, in some ways, still doesn't understand what I do. It's often like, so you're serving the homeless? Why did I send you to college? Jim, when you're set up, can I have you start the biscuits?
Sounds great. Good.
Why do you get pleasure out of helping homeless people? Why do you want to serve them?
I think when I was in high school and when I was in undergraduate, you know, I would see a homeless person on the street, and I was someone who would go, get a job, or like, you're choosing to be homeless. But, you know, I started to learn their stories. I mean, here are people who suffer from a lot of mental illness, possibly drug and alcohol addiction that stem from possibly losing their job, family breakdown, and I realized that once you're down and out and once you're on the street, it's so hard to get back on your feet. So my energy comes by the fact that, wow, if I can start these guys off with a great meal and a nutritious meal, will that increase the odds that maybe they'll get housing, that maybe they'll get off drugs, that maybe they'll have a good day?
And do you think these grits and these home fries and these omelets today will help somebody get a job, get an apartment, get a...
Oh, yeah. When I talk to some of our guests outside as they're leaving, they come up to me and they'll say, oh, that was an awesome meal. Great job. And they're smiling and they're laughing. And I'm not saying that the food made them smile or laugh like as a direct connection, but it's part of the puzzle.
One second.
Oh, Jim, you don't want to over-knead these biscuits or you're going to get rocks.
All right. Can you tell me who you are and what you're doing here?
Sure. My name is Jim Hahn. I volunteer here. I've been here about 4 years. I'm an economist for the Congressional Research Service.
Do you realize you were just on the verge of making those biscuits too tough?
I'm glad that Steve caught me before I did that.
Omelets coming out. Annalisa, can I have you stop what you're doing, wash your hands? You're going to go on the line.
What are you doing now?
Well, we're getting the line open up. We open up in like 5 minutes, so now is really kind of the crash and burn time. Just like a restaurant where you're trying to get ready for the doors to open up.
So you're setting up the cafeteria line.
Sure, exactly.
Sort of like a school lunch cafeteria.
Yes. Hopefully better food.
Now, I notice you have this rolling door shut so that the clients can't see as you're organizing in the kitchen. Why is that?
Then there's that kind of that dramatic, we open up the doors and...
Numbers 1 through 120. Numbers 1 through 120.
Good morning, sir. Potatoes or grits?
No grits, please.
Got it. Good morning, sir. Potatoes or grits?
It ain't breakfast without grits.
All right.
Tell our listeners about Miriam's Kitchen, sir.
It's the greatest breakfast in the city. They treat you like you're a human being, not like a third-class citizen like the city does. This is the best place in town.
Where did you sleep last night?
Well, if I tell you where I sleep at, I'll be harassed by the park police, the city police, and every other police department in the city because they're trying to sweep homelessness under the rug.
Is it all right for us to use your name?
Yeah, my first name is John, and my middle name is Robert, and my last name is McDermott.
Good morning, sir. You know who you remind me of? Charles Bronson, the famous actor.
I've been told that before, but I've got to get my stuff so the other people can eat, too. Is this National Public Radio? You guys are real professionals.
I appreciate that. Before I forget, tell us your name, please.
Oh, they call me Mr. C here. I go to an anonymous organization for my drinking. So we're going to leave it at Mr. C, okay?
I noticed that when you're in the food line, they all offer you lots of choices.
Hey, beautiful. They give you that choice. I mean, this is actually the supreme part of Washington here.
Good morning. What kind of omelet can I get you?
I'm having the omelet with mushrooms and ham.
You know, I always tell volunteers I try to run this like a restaurant kitchen. What I mean by that is the tension that's in a restaurant kitchen in terms of exacting precision in terms of what we're doing. So if I see a volunteer being a little sloppy with something, I said, would you buy that item at a restaurant where you just paid, let's say, $20 for some high-end brunch? And they'll go, no. I said, so why are you making this for our clients and our guests out there? And they should look outside in the dining room and they should say, wow, these are paying customers and I want to be perfect.
But I need to tell you something that might hurt your feelings. I asked one of the gentlemen, what he thinks of the food here. He said, on a 0 to 10 scale, 8.
That's pretty good. But, you know, it's funny. I get yelled at every week by some clients who go, those omelets were overcooked. Or, you know, who taught you how to make those strawberry shortcakes? That's not a shortcake. So it's funny that as we've raised the bar on the type of food we do, they have raised their level of criticism as well. It should push us further.
Leah, I want to know something. I think Steve Batt was actually a little bit hurt that man did not give him a 10.
Well, you know, a lot of chefs are both tender and tough.
You got it.
I have one quick question before you go, though, Danny. Have the general state of the economy and rising food prices hurt Miriam's Kitchen at all?
Yes, they have. Steve Batt says that about half his food comes from corporate-type donations, and corporations are not donating as much as they used to. Now, the church where they work gives him the money to buy the rest of the food, and because, obviously, chicken and meat and fish are so expensive now, he can buy a lot less than he used to with the same amount of money. So he says he's making a lot more vegetarian brunches.
NPR's Daniel Zwerdling. Thanks a lot, Danny.
Thanks, Leanne.
And you can get the recipe for strawberry shortcake at Miriam's Kitchen by going to our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.